So I promised that I would tell you in advance if we do a refresher course, but today we do a refresher course and I didn't tell you in advance. So if you attended diagnostic medical image processing, you already know what we're going to talk about today. So if you get bored, feel free to leave. So this is more or less fundamental knowledge, but maybe it doesn't hurt to rethink about it. But if you already know what homogeneous coordinates are and you're well equipped, so then you will pretty much hear the same story as in the winter term. Nonetheless, there is at least something new. So I told you that there will be this excursion on May 18. And these are the details that I promised. So departure will be on May 18th, and we will have to leave at 6:30 because the workshop starts at 9 a.m. in Munich, and we have to travel there by bus. So we already registered a bus, and so we will depart here at the Computer Science Tower, so at the building over there, at 6:30 already in the morning. So it will be pretty early. But nonetheless, we have already 18 people registered for the trip, and there's only 50 places. So if you want to register, the bus ride will be free. I will bring breakfast, hopefully. And you can register by sending an email to Sven Grünke at FAU.de. He is assembling a list. And if the places are full, he will tell you that there are no more spaces. But this is really a very nice workshop. So we have people from all over the world traveling to Munich. And they're actually deciding the final decisions on conference contributions. But they will also give this workshop, and you will be able to listen to several experts. And we will also put up the link to the website. But the website is not yet public. So there you can see what speakers are coming to this workshop. So this is medical image computing and computer-assisted intervention, and this is very closely related to the topics that we are referring here in the lecture. And it's a really a good, great chance to get to know really well-known people in the field, and I highly recommend taking part here. So only 50 places. So please register as soon as possible if you want to make sure that you get a space, that you get a slot. Okay, good. So much about the commercial. Then we will start with the actual lecture. And today we will do a refresher course. So we will talk about projection models. So projection models and homogeneous coordinates. So I'm sorry, I said that I would already tell you in advance when we do a refresher course, but due to the that we missed the Tuesday lecture in this week, I didn't announce it. I'm very sorry about that. So who knows about projection models and homogeneous coordinates? Okay, so that's less than half. Then there's still some people here to who this will be new. So this is a really, really nice thing, and it's very relevant because we'll be dealing with projection geometries all the time. And just one motivation. So commonly when you talk about projection models, this is often related to computer vision, and there the cameras are really the devices that obey the projection models. But in fact, we have that also in the medical imaging devices, and in particular in X-ray projection images. So they also are formed by a projective transform. And if we want to process X-ray images, it would be good to understand how this image is actually formed. So we already understand that there is a source that is emitting the X-rays, and we are measuring the attenuation. But so far, we have only considered the projection image as a whole, and we talked about effects like scatter and so on. But if we only consider the primary radiation that is directly emitted from the source to the detector, then we can describe this in a projection geometry. And this is basically just a way of describing how a ray passes from the source through the object to the scene. And we want to find ways of describing this in a mathematical notation. So we don't want to set up ray equations for all rays, and then we start with intersecting the volume and individual points. We want to find a nice way of computing this projection. So most of the time, we will be interested in associating a certain position in 3D space with a position in 2D space. So the 3D position and the 2D position. And we will look into that, how to do that efficiently in the next couple of minutes. Furthermore, we now describe the models, but of course also these models you have to calibrate somehow. So you have to find some way how to actually compute your model parameters, and this is then the topic of calibration. So we also dip a bit into the topic of camera calibration and also X-ray projection image calibration. And of course we want then to compute our calibrated camera parameters, and then we can determine very quickly the path of the X-rays, and we want to learn about how to interpret the reliability of those parameters. So what can we do? Let's say in your calibration process, you have some errors. So there's outliers in your data, and you want to identify the outliers and find methods of robustly estimating your projection parameters nonetheless. So this is a short image that shows the original X-ray setup as it was performed in the experiments by Röntgen. And Röntgen had so this is a historical image, so this is not how the imaging systems look today, but the general way of forming the projection is still the same. So you have an X-ray tube that is generating X-rays, and this tube is not shielded whatsoever, so it's irradiating also in this direction, because you have the acceleration current, but the beam is not collimated directly onto the imaging plane, which would be this kind of film that would then gather the X-ray events, so the photons. And then you place your object, in this case it's the hand, that will be imaged, and there's also this famous image that shows a hand with the ring, and you can clearly see the ring and the skeleton inside the hand. And this is the way of how you would or how people used to assemble X-ray projection geometries, and the general principle is still the same. So you have one point where the X-rays emerge from, and then you have a projection pane or plane that gathers the X-rays. And this, if you consider a modern flat panel system, you still have more or less point source that will generate the X-rays, and you have a flat detector where you will gather the X-ray information. So the projection in general is working with the same principles, but now we want to figure out how we can describe this efficiently. And generally what we will want to do is we have, so if you consider reconstruction, you will be interested in reconstructing certain voxel intensities. But or generally, this could also be a continuous 3D space in where your 3D points live. So this is where you have the object space, and then you have the image space, which is a 2D plane. So this is a 2D coordinate system. And we are generally interested in projecting coordinates from a 3D space to a 2D space. And most of the time, we also have to consider discrete coordinates, because if you store 3D volumetric data on a voxel grid, you will have discrete coordinates. And if you have a detector, you typically also have detector elements, so they have also discrete indices. Or in a CCD chip, you also have discrete pixels. And this is the kind of problem that we are tackling, and our optical center is, of course, in this application, the X-ray source. So let's talk a bit about projection geometries. And there's a couple of them, and they have advantages and disadvantages. And we will look into quite simple ones. and will develop more sophisticated from them, from the simple ones. So in the following, we will have an image plane that is fixed and in 3D space, and the 2D image plane is parallel to the XY coordinate system of the 3D space. This means that our coordinate system is aligned in Z-axis. So the Z-axis is the depth of the points, and the XY plane is aligned to the imaging plane. So the Z-axis connects then also the optical center with the imaging plane, and you can, well, you can have different interpretations, so you can go in the one or the other direction, but generally this system is aligned in Z. And this means that the Z-axis is the depth of the respective pixels. Yeah, and of course the image plane is at a fixed point with respect to the origin. So you have some coordinate F where you have the image plane, and this is also referred to as the focal length. And in an orthographic projection, so generally we can now reduce this kind of system into a 2D space, and we do that by kicking out the y-axis. So if we only consider the x-axis here and the z-axis here, so this is z, this is x. Now you can actually draw this kind of coordinate system where you put at a certain distance f, so this is the distance f, and here you put your image plane. And now you have some 3D points, and from the 3D points, we of course only see two components because this is only a 2D image. So we will only observe the X and Z component here. And now we want to do an orthographic projection. And the orthographic projection reduces your 3D space into a 2D space by keeping only the X and Y components. So the Z component, the Z component is discarded. And you can do that by the following matrix. So if you do that, you would get the matrix 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. And you multiply this matrix with x and y and z. And what you get is just the x and y component. And if you think about this in a graphical way, well, if I discard the z component while projecting onto my image plane, I'm simply doing this. I do a projection that is parallel to my z-axis, and I project onto this point, and I discard the information from the z-axis. This has a couple of implications. First of all, the projection is the same for any depth. So if this point would have been here, it would be projected onto the same point. So the depth component is not relevant for this kind of projection. The other implication is that it's irrelevant how you choose F. So you can choose F also at very large scales. It will not affect in any way the way how your projection is performed. So this is invariant to F, and you get rid of the C component. This also means that in such a parallel domain, you are able to shift your imaging plane along the z-axis to any position you like. And in reconstruction, you typically shift then your z-axis such that your detector lies in the origin of the coordinate system, because it makes the subsequent computation much simpler. So this is nice because we have a linear mapping from 3D to 2D. We can write this in a matrix very simply, so we like that. But the bad thing is it doesn't match our usual camera models. So we know that if we have a perspective projection, we are dependent actually on the distance of the on the focal distance. So it does not reflect the projection model that we desire to use very well. So we will it's a kind of artificial projection model. And if you attended diagnostic medical image processing, there are actually imaging geometries that can do orthographic parallel projections, but they are quite cumbersome. So for example, in the first CT scanners, you really had parallel projections, but it essentially boiled down to the fact that you had to move the source. So you had to move, you had to use multiple source positions. So you can do that if you move source and detector along an axis, and then you can really acquire parallel rays. But usually this kind of acquisition geometry is very cumbersome, so it's not used very often. In fact, there are SPECT systems that actually use a parallel imaging, that use parallel imaging, and they do it because they have collimators that are able to generate such an imaging geometry. But these are details. And you will know if you attended diagnostic medical image processing. Okay, so this is pretty artificial because it doesn't reflect changes in depth. So one thing that happens if you change the location and depth is magnification. So if you go closer to your image plane, you will have a larger impression. And if you go closer, let's say you have a point that is here, an object that is here, and if you go closer, then your perspective projection would also result in a bigger magnification. Yeah? So you have magnification, and this model doesn't allow to play with magnification at all. So what could we do? Well, we could do a simple trick. We could put in a magnification constant. So let's say the depth is more or less constant, and we put in a magnification constant. And if we do that, we can just alter this model by introducing some factor k. And this is now called weak perspective projection. And here we do an additional scaling on the detector pane. So what we do is we project onto the detector, and then we multiply with k. So if we want to have a magnification, we choose a k that is bigger than 1, then we will get a bigger image. And we want to have a demagnification, then we choose a k that is smaller than 1, and we will get a smaller image. So this then results in the so-called weak perspective model, and it's difficult to draw because the scaling actually happens in this plane. But if you think about it as a scaling, just as a linear scaling, and you choose a k that is smaller, you could also think about that you first do an orthographic projection, and then you virtually scale down your image. Yeah? And if you have a positive k, you virtually scale up your image. As if you have a k greater than 1, you virtually scale up the image. So this is how you could interpret that. And the resulting projection then would, of course, look like this. So you have k, 0, 0, 0, k, 0, and you multiply with your 3D point. So this kind of model is nice because it's still linear. We can just write it in a matrix multiplication, and we are able to deal with effects of magnification. But it's still not a perspective model. So what we want to have in the end is a perspective projection model. So what could we do? Well, let's think about another extension. And now we do something which is called paraperspective projection. And you will see what we're aiming at is a perspective projection. And we will just see in a couple of minutes why we don't like the perspective projection that much. But we are doing this paraperspective projection. So let's think about how this works. So let's follow the recipe on the right side. So this is again Z. And now we have a couple of points. So these are the points that we want to image. And now step one says, if multiple points are projected, an auxiliary plane through the point centroid and parallel to the image plane is defined. OK, so let's say this is the centroid. And we have our image plane, it's still the same, and we still have the focal distance f. So this was f, this is the image plane. And now we need a plane through the centroid and parallel to the image plane. Okay, this is the image plane, this is the centroid, so we need something which goes along here. This is parallel to the image plane and goes through the centroid. And what we do next is, then a parallel projection is applied to map all points onto this auxiliary plane, where the projection direction is parallel to the vector defining the centroid. So a parallel projection applied to all points onto this auxiliary plane where the projection is parallel to the vector defining the centroid. So the vector defining the centroid is this vector. Okay? And now we project onto this plane along this vector. So we project here, we project here, we project here, and we project here, and we project here. So this is all along the vector. And we project onto this plane. Okay? And now we have this kind of projection. So everything is now in a plane, on the auxiliary plane. And now the points on the auxiliary plane are mapped by perspective projection onto the image plane. So it means that we perform a scaled orthographic projection. So this is now, so now all the points are on this plane. And now I can do a, now I can do my my perspective projection, but they're all on one plane. So I do the perspective projection, and what you will see is that actually I am just doing a scaled orthographic projection. So because the relation on this plane doesn't change anymore, so this is just a scaling that is the same for all of these points. And I scale it down to this plane. So this follows the, this is essentially what we called a weak perspective projection. So the only difference is that we project parallel onto this auxiliary plane before. So we have a parallel projection followed by a weak perspective projection. And we then, because these two mappings have been linear, we can find out that this mapping is also an affine mapping. So this mapping is also affine, but it's still not the perspective projection. So what we actually want to do is a perspective projection, and this perspective projection would have been this guy here. So we have a couple of points, and now we have our image plane. This is still the distance f. And we want to project onto this plane by connecting the 3D point and the optical center. And this is the kind of projection that we would like to get. And you can see that these two points, they are projected almost onto the same point because they fall almost onto the same ray. So this is the kind of projection that we would like to get. This is the perspective projection. But the problem is, if we do that, we will get a projection that will project a point x, y, and z, and this will be projected onto something like f times x over z and f times y over z. So this is dependent on the z coordinate. Okay? Can you find a matrix that I put in between here that will give me this mapping? No, you can't. You can't find a mapping that will take the Z component. So if you would like to design such a mapping, your matrix would probably look like this. So you need X, Y, and Z, and you want it to be mapped onto here. So you would still need your matrix. So this will have Z components. So what you would like to do is multiply with F over Z here and F over Z here and put zeros in here. So this is what you'd like to do. But now Z is dependent on the depth of your point. So you would have to have a different matrix for every different depth. Yeah? So this is not, well, this is kind of linear, but it's actually not, because you have to get 1 over Z in here. And you can't find a linear mapping that will do that. Okay? So this is the trouble that we're in. This is why we did all these nice tricks with weak perspective projection and then parallel perspective projection all of them we did, because then we have very nice linear mappings, and with nice linear mappings we know we can use stuff like the singular value decomposition, so we want to have a linear mapping. And now we have this stupid perspective mapping, and it doesn't work anymore. So we can't do it. Stupid. What do? We use power perspective mappings and say this approximates the reality. Well, this is one way to do it, but if you have trouble with your parameter estimation, it's pretty clear, because the model doesn't reflect the reality. So you will always have trouble if you use your power perspective. For certain applications, it's maybe valid, it may work. But in general, so in particular, if your points are of approximately all the same depth, then your power perspective model is already pretty good. But if you have really a huge difference in depth, your power perspective model won't work very well. So what do we do? Well, we have to find some trick how to solve this problem. And this is a summary of the graphs that I've shown here. So this is the perspective, the orthogonal, the power perspective, and the weak perspective in a single graph. Good. Well, 1 and 3 can be expressed in terms of a linear mapping. Projection 4 is... So, careful. 1 and 3 are the... it's in a different sequence now. So it's the orthogonal and the weak perspective can be expressed in a linear mapping. We have them here. The projection, the weak, the power perspective projection is an affine mapping, and the perspective projection is nonlinear, because we have to divide over Z and we can't write that in a matrix. But what we want to have is our perspective projection. So this is too bad. So what will we do? Well, and you already had the hint in the very beginning, because it's projection models and homogeneous coordinates. Well, if the space that we're working in is not suited, maybe we can apply a trick and find some kind of model where we suddenly have a linear relationship, and we do that using homogeneous coordinates. So now homogeneous coordinates is generally a very useful trick that is used all over in computer vision. You use it in computer graphics. Every time you have perspective projection models, you use homogeneous coordinates. So this is a simple trick, and we expand our vectors by another component. So we put our 3D points into a virtual 4D space, and we put our 2D points into a virtual 3D space. And this is pretty cool, because with this we can write affine mappings as linear mappings, and we can use the perspective projection, we can also write as a linear mapping. So this is very nice. We will see how to do that in the next couple of slides. So let's start with the 2D case and consider what has happened if we expand it by an additional component. So we can do that. And what happens now is, so let's stay in the same kind of notation that we do here. So let's consider actually a 1D space and put it into a perspective space. So we have a 1D space. This is our 1D space. And now we take this 1D space and we have points here, and we have points here. So let's say this is the index 0. And now we put this into a perspective space. So we add a second component, and this is actually where we have 1. So we just said we expand our space by simply adding another dimension, and we put 1 in here. Which means that if I have, for example, the position 1 here, and this is the 0 of the perspective space, then a point with index 1, 1 will be exactly on our original space, and it will have the original scaling. And what happens now is, I can also put this original space here, this is parallel to this one. And what is happening now is, if I change the last component, I changed the magnification. So my perspective space works as follows. The last component identifies as scaling. And now the scaling with 1, I'm exactly here. And if I increase, I go greater than 1, then I walk along this line. And if I go smaller than 1, then I'm demagnifying. But in this perspective space, all points that are on this line are the same, because I can normalize back to my original space by dividing over the last component. So I call maybe the last component W, and this is now where I have W equals 1. I'm back in my original space, and I can normalize by the last component. I just have trouble if I'm exactly here at my projection space. Yeah? So we also have to think about what happens if I have 0 at the last component. Because if I have 0 at the last component, then I can't map back onto here, because if I divide over 0, I run into problems. Yeah? Okay, so this is the way how we can expand a 1D space. And of course, you can do the same with a 2D space and a 3D space. So you add another component, but it's difficult to imagine this in 3D, because then everything is scale variance. So you can have objects of different scale or points of different scale, and they're still the same. But generally, the equivalence relation is, if they are on the same line, they're equivalent. And this means that I have a couple of new things that we have to define. So we have a point in the original, so here it's 2D in the original space, and this is X and Y, and this is an R2. And we can now present this as a new point, WX, WY, and W, and this is in a perspective space. So we now call this space P. So this is P square, and this is a perspective version of our R2 space, which means that the last component is essentially the scaling. And now we have W as an arbitrary real value constant. So we have the singularity if W is 0, because then we can't go back to our original space. And generally, you can go back from a vector in homogeneous, in our perspective space, into our normal real valued space by dividing over the last component if it's not 0. So I can, from any point ABC, I can go back to my 2D representation by dividing over the last component. That's already the trick. So this is the kind of formalism that we will use, and now we will look at a couple of things and how these things behave in this space. Well, we already know the mapping into this perspective space. We just add a 1 at the end of the vector. And then we have any 2D point can be expanded to this 3D point by adding a 1 at the end. And the representation has a singularity if W equals to 0. Yeah? So you won't be able to go back to your original space if that happens. And now we have a homogeneous point, and it's generally denoted with this tilde in the following. So we have a vector, and the tilde shows us it's a homogeneous point. And those homogeneous points have certain properties. For example, 2 points are equivalent, they're the same, if the homogeneous points equals to some constant lambda times the other. So if they're linear dependent, if you have 2 points that are linear dependent, they are equivalent, they're the same. And sometimes, of course, lambda must not be 0, yeah? Because if you put in 0, all points would be 0. So it's a non-zero constant. And we denote this equivalence with an equality sign and a tilde over it. So this tells us that this is a projective equivalence. Yeah? So this is how we denote the equivalence between 2 points. But now the identity is not the exact identity, but it's identity up to scaling. So it's often called identity up to scaling. And now you can have the example, the point 2, 3, 1, and the point 4, 6, 2. And of course, if you divide Q over 2, you will end up at 2, 3, 1. This means these 2 points are equivalent in this perspective space. because both of them go down to the original point of 2, 3 in the original 2D space. If you would have considered this as vectors in R3, they would of course not be equal. Yeah? This is only true if you're in a perspective space, this special kind of equality. And now you can also think about lines in 2D. In general, you can write a line down as an equation that has the following format. So it's A times X plus B times Y plus Z equals 0. So this is a line equation in 2D. And now, if you look at this equation, you can see that you can multiply this line with an arbitrary constant, non-zero factor, and it would still represent the same line. So you can now actually take a vector ABC in R3, and this represents a line. And you can scale this vector with an arbitrary constant W, which will still be the same line. So in this way, we can represent lines in homogeneous coordinates just as as a vector with three elements. So this boils down to a line. And now you can do an intersection with a point, and you will see that if the inner product of the line with a point equals to zero, then this point lies on the line. So you can use the inner product between the point and the line and figure out whether this point lies on the line. Or you can also intersect two lines, and you will see that if you want to intersect two lines, well, you need to find the point that lies on the one line and on the other line, and of course this point in this perspective space there needs to be zero, and you can see that you get the intersection of two lines simply as the cross product of the two vectors. This is a very interesting feature, and if you follow this, you can arrive at a concept called duality. But for the time being, so the cross product is very interesting in this kind of perspective spaces. But for the time being, just realize that you can very elegantly now compute intersection points of two lines simply by the cross product. So this is very nice. Then we have a set of ideal points. We call this the set of ideal points, and this is the line at infinity. And we define this as a line that has the components 0, 0, and 1. And now that we have the set of ideal points and the points that lie at infinity, you can see that any point that lies on this line is a point that must have 0 on the last component. So any point that has a zero on the last component will lie on this line. Yeah? Because if you have a non-zero value here, you will get a non-zero inner product. So this kind of line shows you points that lie at infinity. And this is a very interesting example. Now you can do some testing. So you can take down some notes and play with that. What happens if you take two parallel lines and intersect them? Where will they intersect? So this is interesting. You can try that. Okay. And in general, this concept of homogeneous coordinates can be transferred to higher dimensional spaces, but we won't look into too much detail of these concepts. So there's much more to tell about this point, but for this class, we will just stay with the interpretation of homogeneous coordinates up to this point. And if you want to know more about that, I really recommend Hartley's book, which you will find at the end of the slides as a reference. So there you can find more details about how to play with homogeneous coordinates and projective spaces. Good. Now let's go back to the original problem. Now we introduced homogeneous coordinates, and now we want to figure out how can we use that for our projections. Well, we had this problem that we wanted to divide over the Z component. And if we do that now here, and we write the following mapping, so you write this mapping 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and 3 zeros and 1. And we apply this to our homogeneous point, x, y, z, 1. We will see what does emerge from that. Which mapping do I get from that? Yeah, the orthographic mapping. Very well. It's good that it's written on the slides. Okay, so I will get x, y, and 1. And this is exactly our orthographic projection. And now the trick is, can you imagine how you can expand this to a perspective projection? Yes? Who said yes? Yeah, so you swap this line. Yeah. So we wanted to get to the point fx fy divided over c. So if I map this guy to homogeneous components, I can choose any value to multiply with. And I want to get rid of the 1 over c. So what value do I pick to multiply? So I want to go from this point into a 3D space, into this perspective 3D space, and I want to kick out the 1 over c. So I want to multiply with some value to kick out the 1 over c. Z, yes. So I want to get at fx, fy, and then I put z here. Because if I go back from the perspective space, from the projective space into the original space, I have to divide over the last component. So this is essentially the trick that we want to use. And now I want to find a linear mapping that will create exactly this vector. So how does this mapping look like? So F 0, 0, 0, yes. F 0, 0, 0, okay. 0, F 0, 0, and now? Double 0, 1, and 0. Yes. This matrix will exactly deliver this vector. Okay? So this is just a trick. So I appended one dimension. And by the way, I can also switch this. So this is a constant f. Yeah. So if I divide over f, I can also find a different point which is equivalent. So I can also go to the point x, y, and then, so I divide over f, c over f. This is also the same point, because this is only different by a lambda that equals to f in this case. So this point and this point is the same. And of course, if you divide over the last component, you will also end up at this point. So this means that I can also write down this kind of matrix that will deliver exactly, it will deliver exactly the same projection, but I can write this matrix also as 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and now I put 1 over f. Sorry, 1 over f, and this. So this matrix and this matrix will deliver exactly the same projection. Which brings us to another interesting property of projections in a homogeneous space. Those projection matrices, they are also identical up to scaling. So you can multiply this with an arbitrary factor A, and it will still be the same projection matrix. So there's an infinite number, because I can choose any a that is greater than zero. So it can choose any a and multiply this matrix with, and I still have this exactly the same projection. And because I divide over the last component in my dehomogenization, I will still get the same point. So generally, if we're looking for projection matrices in this kind of space, we will have an infinite number of solutions. So you usually have to think about this problem when you do the optimizations. Huh? Okay, good. Yeah, and here you see one solution, and we have this solution this is the weak perspective projection. So in the weak perspective projection, you just replace this 1 with a 1 over k, which will result in the multiplication with k. Of course, you could also put k, k, and 1 to end up with the same projection. So the same holds also for this kind of projection matrix. And you can also end up in the perspective projection. And now in the perspective projection, we have f, f, and 1 here on the truncated diagonal of the matrix. Very well. So this is nice, because now we have a linear mapping. So this is very nice when we are when we want to calibrate such projection matrices. We can use methods from linear math to actually compute those projection matrices. So this is very nice. Good. So let's talk a bit about cameras, and let's talk a bit about extrinsic camera parameters. Typically, when you have a camera system or X-ray and source detector system, your camera will be aligned at some point in a world coordinate system. So it generally will not be, the optical center will generally not be at the center of your world coordinate system and will be aligned with the Z-axis. So the direction that you're looking at is usually not aligned with the Z-axis. So in order to do that, in order to be able to apply this kind of projection, you first have to rotate and translate your world coordinate system in a way that it is aligned with your camera coordinate system. And this is why we need extrinsic parameters. So we now have a linear mapping, and this linear mapping here tells us how to do the perspective projection if we are in a perfect camera coordinate system, meaning that the origin is exactly the optical center and the z-axis is looking along the optical axis, meaning that this is the ray that is perpendicular to the image plane. Good. So, well, we could say, okay, we always have to put the world coordinate system into the optical center. That would be one way to go. Or you define two additional mappings, and these will be rotation and translation. And now the nice thing is, this is an affine mapping. And also, as we already heard, in this homogeneous space, we can write this affine mapping also as a linear mapping. So our rotation and translation can also very nicely be described in this homogeneous coordinate space. So this is one example where you can see that generally your camera also in medical imaging, you will have motion in between. So you are able to move your camera. So you move the X-ray source and the detector. And this is a C-arm system where you have a flat panel detector here and the source X-ray source on the opposite side. Note that the source is actually in here. And this huge thing here is actually the collimator. So this is used for beam shaping, that you actually only irradiate the part of the detector and nothing more. Good. So this is the kind of system that we maybe want to use. And you will see that the source and detector position will change with respect to our acquisition, or may change with respect to our acquisition. So we need to be able to model that. And what we will traditionally do, if we were in R3, we would have a rotation matrix, and we multiply with the rotation matrix, and then we add a translation vector. And this is affine, and you always have the multiplication and the addition. And now the nice thing is, if you expand this into a homogeneous space, you can actually find this in a single matrix. And the matrix will be composed as such that you have the rotation matrix here. Then the last column vector will be the translation vector and the 1. And this last row will only be composed of zeros and a 1. So this is generally how you construct an affine mapping from a 3D Euclidean space into a 4D projective space. Well, how does the rotation matrix look like? We already discussed that when we reviewed SVD. I mean, this is how you just have to expand it to 3D. So we already know that the columns of a linear mapping are the images of the base vectors, and this is how you can find your rotation matrix. Okay, so this is nice because this is a 4x4 matrix, and this 4x4 matrix is applied to your 3D point, to your 4D point, and then we want to project. Okay, keep that in mind. Good. So let's talk about camera intrinsics. So a camera usually also does a couple of things with the data, and typically your camera, for example, has an own camera coordinate system, and it's applying transformations on the chip itself. And typically, you will have the origin of your camera coordinate system will not lie exactly at the optical center. So it won't be aligned with the optical axis. So the point that is projecting the optical center onto the space perpendicularly will usually not have the coordinate 0, 0, but it will be somewhere on your detector. So there's, of course, a shift of the optical center. And then there may be things like that you have skewed axis. So if you have an imperfect chip, you may have a slant in the two axes. They may not be perfectly perpendicular. So this may happen. And of course, you may have pixels that have a different height and width. So this may also happen. Then you have different scalings along your two axes. So there's a couple of things that can also happen on the chip. So let's see, did I say everything? So the intrinsic parameters usually don't change if the camera moves. So the global motion of the camera is all captured in the extrinsic parameters. So intrinsic parameters are only parameters that are that happen actually on the projection on this on the projection on the chip or on the detector system. And generally the origin is not in the center. The axis may be at a certain skew angle, so they may be not perfect 90 degrees, and you have different scalings on X and Y, which may happen if you don't have uniform pixels. And there might be a radial distortion to the camera optics, but we don't consider it here. Okay, so this is the general outline. This is the kind of coordinate system that you would like to have. This is the kind of coordinate system where we project it to. And this had this point here was exactly in line with the optical center, and this is the projected point. But now your camera system certainly has an angle here, so there's two axes, so this of course is exaggerated. Usually you don't have such a high degree of skew. You would expect this angle to be approximately 90 degrees, and then generally you have a different origin, because typically your chip or your detector is indexed at 0, 0, either at the bottom left corner or at the top left corner. So you may have a different orientation of the origin. And this kind of transformation also has to be captured when you do the final projection. Because in the end, you want to plug in 3D world coordinates, and you want to get pixel coordinates in your image. This is what you want to have in the end. So you have 3D world coordinates, you do your projection, and in the end you get pixel coordinates. So these are the parameters that we already introduced. So what you want to have is you want on the x-axis you want the scaling with kx, and on the y-axis you want to have the skew angle of your rotation of the axis be considered, which brings us to a kind of mapping, this is the affine mapping that is only caused by the skew of the axis and the different spacing of the pixels. And this would give you the following transformation. So this is the transformation matrix, and this is the inverse. Okay, so we have this matrix T, which is only the coordinate system that is happening on top, which is happening on the chip. But then you also have this translation, because the optical center is not at the right location. So you also have to have a shift. So you have the skew and the shift, and you put the shift in here. And then you get this kind of 3x3 matrix. And this is now actually an affine mapping, because it's a skew matrix and a translation. But then again, we can use the trick of homogeneous coordinates and use a 3x3 matrix in order to describe in homogeneous coordinates this affine mapping. So we end up with a 3x3 matrix, which is called the camera matrix, and this has all the intrinsic parameters in there. So we have a 3x3 matrix, and this only works within your projection plane. Again, a homogeneous perspective space, but this time it's only 2D. So it ends up in a 3x3 matrix. Okay, and this boils down that we can get a complete projection. And now the complete projection is giving in a projection matrix P. And now this projection matrix P is determined as K multiplied with our projection matrix here. So this is the guy that we have here. And then with this matrix D, which was describing the extrinsic parameters. So we have a set of three matrices, and we just multiply the three matrices up. And in the end, we get a single matrix. This is a 3x4 matrix. And you will only have this single matrix to describe the entire projection. So camera pose is included, intrinsic parameters are included, and the projection, all in a single matrix. So you can multiply this up. And these are the three components. And generally, if you work with libraries that work with projection matrices, there's also ways how to decompose your projection matrix back into the camera matrix, into the projection matrix, and the intrinsic parameters. So you can, only from the projection matrix, you can determine rotation, translation, and the camera parameters. Of course, up to scale, because the entire projection process is also only described up to scale. This essentially tells you that you know where the optical center is, but you don't know the size of the pixels. So if you know the size of your projected image, then you can also get the projection up to scale. Okay. So now we know how to describe this very efficiently. So it's just a single matrix multiplication. If we go from 3D to 2D, just a single matrix multiplication, and you're done. Well, you have to dehomogenize, but this is about it. Now we have to calibrate this. And generally, you have to know your... So this, essentially, if you build very accurately your device, you know those parameters by design, but there's always a certain uncertainty when you manufacture the device. Also, focal length might be changing, and generally the extrinsic, so this holds for the intrinsic parameters, and generally the extrinsic parameters may change. So what you want to do is you want to compute all of these parameters at the same time, and you use that with a calibration pattern. And in order to do so, you take a calibration pattern, and the calibration pattern has, you assume that, so you build the calibration pattern in a way that you exactly know the 3D coordinates. And then your coordinate system will be, your world coordinate system will be attached to this calibration pattern. So the calibration pattern defines your 3D world coordinate system, and then you do projections of this object with known 3D correspondence, and you do the projection, and then you have to figure out points on the projection which you can relate to your original phantom. And if you can do that, then you are able to identify 2D positions, you know the 3D positions, and you plug them in and compute your projection matrix. This is the general idea. And then you want to do that probably with a least square estimator. So you can use SVD at this point. So this is a kind of calibration pattern. So here you can see this is a kind of see-through cylinder, and it has a sequence of beads embedded here. And the sequence of beads is, of course, that you can get corresponding points. So you manufactured this kind of fandom that you have exactly defined those beads and manufactured this very accurately. And then you do a projection, and you would try to align this kind of fandom in a way that you place it maybe like this, and you place the optical center here. And then in your projection, the back part will be projected onto a different location than the front part. Huh? So then you are able to differentiate the two, and then you can decode the bead sequence. You can see those beads, and then you are able to calibrate. So this kind of pattern was thought to be applied as a kind of crown. Yeah? So you have a patient, you perform a head scan, and now let's say this is the head of the patient. Then you can track this bead sequence and this bead sequence, and you have a kind of online calibration. Unfortunately, there's a couple of problems with this, because first of all, your calibration points will only be in this part of the projection image, which is not very nice. And the other problem is you have interference with the object. So it's difficult to identify those beads because it is overlaid with the object information. So this kind of calibration pattern, in the end, was only used as a prototype. And this would have been the speed sequence. And you have those, you can identify those arrows here. This is the stop sequence, so this is a stop code. And in between the arrows, you have a kind of bit pattern that you can use to decode the ID of every bead. So, unfortunately, this phantom didn't make it. Then there's very well-known phantoms that are used in camera calibration. They use either checkerboard patterns or dot patterns. And with these dot patterns, you are also able to get very well-specified locations. So you also have to design and manufacture this phantom very accurately. And then what people use in 3D flat panel imaging is this PDS2 calibration phantom. So if you have worked with a C-arm system, you will probably know this calibration phantom. And this has spheres aligned on a helix. And this pattern is scanned, and then this helix is also very nicely projected onto the detector. So there's very little problem with overlays. And you can use the beads in order to identify the position of the phantom. And now the trick is that this has a total of 108 steel spheres, and those spheres will more or less absorb all of the radiation. So you can very clearly see that in the projection image. And there is smaller spheres and bigger spheres. And now with those small and bigger spheres, you can encode a bit sequence. And a sequence of 8 spheres in a row will have a unique bit sequence. So you can find 8-bit sequences in 108, in a sequence of 108 spheres or bit, and those sequences are unique. So if you have decoded 8 beads in a row, you will exactly know which IDs those beads have. So this bit pattern of 8 subsequent beads is unique, and it only appears once in the sequence. So if you do that, you can then, if you have identified 8 beads, let's say you have identified those 8 beads, those 8 beads, and those 8 beads, then you exactly know the IDs. And with that, you have correspondence between 2D and 3D. And you can now compute the projection matrix. So you have points in 2D that you have identified, so use the centroid of the beads. And you have points in 3D, then you know them by design, because you had the phantom manufactured in such a way, and then you are able to actually scan this phantom. Good. Remember, if you do a calibration, your world coordinate system will be attached to the phantom. So if you rotate it, so if you want to find something about reproducibility, so and a nice thing about the C-arm systems is when you accelerate and decelerate, they start swinging. And this is often referred to as the wobble, because the system, up to a couple of millimeters, they wobble like this during acceleration and deceleration. So people said, okay, you can never do 3D imaging because this kind of wobble is very strange and it's difficult to capture. But the nice thing is, if you repeat this wobble, it will be reproducible. And in fact, it is stable up to 1 year on the same device. So you calibrate with the system once, and you can use the calibration for up to 1 year if you have very good hardware. There's also systems where you have to calibrate every morning because this hardware is not as reproducible as other systems. But if you now try to do a reproducibility study over a year, and every morning you place your phantom in you, you will very quickly realize that from one day to the next day, you will never have reproducible results, just because you have your world coordinate system attached to the phantom. And every time you place the phantom in you, you have a new alignment of the system, which immediately changes the extrinsic parameters. Yeah. So if you want to do a reproducibility study, you either have to keep the phantom in place, or you have to normalize for it. So you have to somehow compute back onto your... So because when you have calibrated your system, you can, from every projection matrix, you can compute back the optical center. And what you do then is you normalize your world coordinate system with respect to your sequence of projections. So let's say you have acquired 133 projections along an arc, and you do the same rotation every time, then you normalize not to the position of the phantom, but you compute the optical centers, the X-ray source positions with respect to the phantom, and then you apply a rotation translation such that the world coordinate system coincides with the isocenter and lies in the plane of rotation. And then you can normalize for these effects. But we won't do it in this class, but if you ever have to do a reproducibility study, keep in mind, once you have changed the phantom, your world coordinate system will also be moved. And this will give you pretty crazy results if you're not aware of that. So you'll say, oh, nothing is ever reproducible, but it's just because you have moved the phantom. And if you go into some research facility and somebody is doing such a study, and you start moving the phantom, he may become very upset. Because maybe he thought he would acquire data for 20 days and see if it's reproducible, and on day 18 you come in and move his phantom, he might be no longer your friend. Okay, good. Well, we can play with the math and think about how we can calibrate this. Well, now we have the P's known because we know them from our phantom design, and the Q's we know because we have figured out which point in the projection belongs to which 3D point. And what we then have to solve is a kind of least square problem over all points I in 2D and 3D space, and figure out the optimal parameter set. Here in this example, it's only F. And you can then build this into a least square problem, which will more or less then result in the following problem. You have to find the minimal F with respect to this optimization problem here. So you can do the math at home if you're interested. So this would be a very simple minimization problem. But you can also manipulate the problem, and you can start also normalizing, for example, with this factor, and then you get a new least square estimator. And you can actually further massage this equation, and then you end up with this least square problem. And actually, this is quite some fun if you implement this. You can try in MATLAB and implement it and see what kind of estimator is best suited for your purposes. Okay, so let's skip this a bit. This is not so interesting right now. It's more interesting to think about the full projection matrix problem. And if you have the full projection matrix, you have these 12 unknowns, then you have these unknowns. So you have for every point that you have tracked, you essentially end up with three equations. And what you now need to do, yes? This thing here?
Yeah, right. Well,
this only estimates the focal length. So there's only one unknown parameter in here. Mm-hmm. And if I go to this problem, I have suddenly 12 unknowns, which are the elements of my matrix. And this estimates the intrinsic, the extrinsic, F, and all the parameters in our projection matrix at once. Okay. So we are calibrating intrinsics, extrinsics, everything at once. And what can we do now? Well, we can see if we divide this whole thing, so we have three equations here essentially, and if we divide by the last column, we end up with these two equations for yi0 and yi1, and you will see that this equation is nonlinear in P. But of course we can put this into a least square optimization problem, but this is nonlinear, so this is not very nice to work with this, because the parameters that we are looking for are the p's, and p appears down here, so we don't want to have this kind of optimization problem. Instead, what we can do is, well, we can just multiply with this term. And then we get something which is linear in P. So this is very nice. And now we have two equations that are linear in P, and we can rewrite this into a measurement matrix. So this is what we do all the time. We rewrite stuff into a measurement matrix. And now suddenly the elements of P are in this vector. And M is the measurement matrix, and this contains the 2D and the 3D points. So this is the kind of structure that emerges from here. And you can just rearrange your observed data into this measurement matrix and put it in here. And then you end up with a null space problem. And how do we solve null space problems? SVD, exactly. So we do SVD, and we're there. There you go. And this actually works very nicely. So we compute the null space, and the rank of this matrix is 11. So we know how to get P. Very well. Good. But you can also put this into an eigenvalue eigenvector problem. Then you end up with minimizing this norm, subject to that the norm, so the Frobenius norm essentially of P, is going to be 1. And then you can solve it with the Lagrange multiplier method. So it's also one way of solving this. And so if you actually do this, then you compute the derivative. This will be your derivative, and then you get m transpose m times p equals lambda p, and then you can essentially get your projection matrix parameters as eigenvector of m transpose m. So the and you can use that, so you can have now a linear method to compute your parameters. And the nice thing is now that you can also use this linear estimate as an initialization for a nonlinear method. So with the nonlinear method, you have the problem that you may get stuck in local minima, but if you have already a good estimate, you can use this as initialization and then use things like local optimizers like gradient descent. Very well. Okay. So this all works nice, these square optimizers, this all works nice, unless you have outliers. So let's say you have figured out the correspondence wrong. So let's say you have bead number 106, and you assigned ID 2. So then you have a great outlier because you have the wrong assignment between the beads. And this is where a method comes in extremely handy, which is called RANSEC, random sample consensus. And random sample consensus is really, really useful if you have outliers. So if you have misalignment between beads, then you can use RANSEC, and it will dramatically help you. So one thing is, of course, noise. And noise, if you have random noise over your data, you can use least square methods. This will be quite useful. But if you have outliers and they are like a wrong correspondence, it can produce a really big outlier. And if you look at a regression problem, and let's say you have this outlier here, this is point number 7, and these are the points. This is the regression line that you want to estimate. So they all fall very nicely onto this line, but then there is this outlier number 7. And if you actually now estimate the regression line with point 7, then you will realize that you get this line here. So you get a line that is very far off to this line. So this is the line that we actually wanted to have, and this is the line that we get. So if we kick out 7, then we get this line, and this line is very, very close to what we actually wanted to get. But if we kick out number 6, so if we kick out an inlier, then we get this line, and this line is not very useful. So it's again very close. So you have to kick out the right outlier in order to get a good model of your data. And you do that with RANSEC. In RANSEC, you draw as few points as possible, because you want to have models that have only inliers. And if you have a line, you actually only need 2 points, right? So you can estimate the line equation from 2 points. So in this example, from your 7 points, you would randomly draw 2 points and try to estimate the line. And then from this line, you count the number of inliers. So from the line, you have a model. And now you use the model on all of your data, and you count how many points are close to this line. And you can define inliers in different ways. One way to define inliers is that the distance between the line and the point is lower than a certain threshold, let's say 1. So if the distance is smaller than 1, then it's an inlier. And if the distance is greater than 1, it's an outlier. And now you do that, and you repeat this random sampling until you have found a model that consists only of inliers. And with this model only of inliers, you probably have a very good estimate. Then you count the inliers for all your models, and in the end, you choose the model that had the most inliers. Good. But one problem that you have with this algorithm generally is, now how often do I have to draw? Yeah? Do I have to take 10 points, or do I have to take 100 points? So how often do I have to actually draw from the data? And what helps there is a small trick. So whenever you use RANSEC, be very careful, because if you have 2 less tries, so if you only try 10 times, you may end up having a model that still has an outlier. So what you want to have is a model that has only inliers. Okay? So if you use RANSEC, and you get some results with that, and you have too few tries, too few repetitions of how often you draw, you end up with very bad estimates. So if you do RANSEC, you have to first think about how often you have to actually draw from your distribution. And you can do that by a very simple kind of terms of math. So let's say you want to have a model, and it has 5 parameters, and you have to draw 5 points from your data set. Yeah? And let's say the probability of inlier is 90%, so it's 0.9. This means that the probability of an outlier is 10%. If you have higher probabilities for outliers, you may have pretty bad data. But let's say 10% are outliers. And how can you find that out? What the probability for in and outlier is? Yeah, you count. You need a representative set of data, and then you count how many inliers, how many outliers, how many data in total, and this is how you determine your in and outliers. Yes?
Wait, but then I have to know the regression line. So if I want to classify outliers and inliers, I already have to have the result.
Well, be careful. So you want to estimate different regression lines. So every time you move your camera, you want to estimate a new regression line, right? But what you need to know is how big is the probability of doing a false correspondence. And the false correspondence should be independent of the camera position. So if you have a dependence in between the correspondence problem and the parameters that you set, then you really run into a problem. But usually you can get this. So this is, you can also do an educated guess. So what I'm aiming here is if you get random results using RANSEC, then it's probably because you don't have enough tries. And if you do an educated guess for these probabilities, you already end up with some hints on how often you have to draw from a distribution. Let's say this process, I'm drawing, so I want to have 5 points. So my number of parameters is 5, yeah? And I'm drawing. So essentially, I'm drawing from the set of points, and this is a Bernoulli trial. So if I want to have a model that consists only of inliers, the probability for this, so P and now all inliers, yeah? This is then, of course, the probability of the inlier, and I'll have to draw 5 times and only get inliers. So it's 0.9 to the power of 5. This means that the probability that I have a single outlier, and the single outlier is already a flawed model, so the probability for a flawed model, flaw, is then 1 minus 0.9 to the power of 5. Okay, so this is the probability of a flawed model. Now, what I actually want to say is, well, I want to determine the probability that I have at least one model with all inliers is sufficient. So how often do I have to try that I have at least one model with only inliers? Well, and I know I want to have at least one inlier model. So let's call this only the probability for at least. And this, I want to set this to 0.999. So I want to be very sure that I have at least one inlier. So I just set this probability. And I know that I can compute this probability. So the probability for at least one inlier is the probability, well, of 1 minus, and this means only flawed models. Yeah? So if I draw only flawed models, then I didn't make it. And this is, of course, again a Bernoulli try, and this is p flawed to the power of n. And this is the probability that I'm going to set as my certainty threshold. And now you can readily, so we know p flaw, we know this guy, and now we can solve for n. So what we do is we take the logarithm on both sides. So we end up with the logarithm from P at least equals to the logarithm of 1 minus, so first we have to go to this thing. Okay. So we need to subtract 1 and then multiply with minus 1. Then we end up with this. So we need the logarithm of 1 minus p at least equals to the logarithm of p flawed to the power of n. And now I can pull this here, and I get n as the division of the two logarithms. Yeah? And if you do that, you can get an estimate of your n. And you can type that into your calculator later. This is probably quite a bit. Yeah. You have to try a couple of times. Yeah. Dependent on how many lines you put here. Yeah. Because this will give you this probability, and this is how you can compute n. Do you want me to write down n? Oh, this is great. So n is going to be the logarithm of 1 minus p at least over the logarithm of p flaw. There you go. This is n. And you can type it into your calculator. But every time you ransack, I would highly recommend to do this kind of estimation, that you get a feeling how many tries you have to do in order to get at least one inlier, and at least one model that consisted only of inliers. OK, good. Take-home messages. We talked about projection models. We talked about that perspective projection is nonlinear. Then we found out that we can fix it with homogeneous coordinates. So with homogeneous coordinates, we do this trick that we expand by one dimension, and we suddenly everything gets linear. Then we were talking about camera calibration using least squares. And if you attended diagnostic medical image processing, you will very easily have followed this, because this is how we solve problems all the time. If this was a bit quick, you can go through the slides. I think they describe it quite well. And ransack algorithm in order to cope with outliers. And of course, be aware how often you have to try to draw from your distribution until you really have a good chance of getting a model with only inliers. OK, so some further readings. I already referred to Hartley's book, Multiple View Geometry in Computer Vision. So it is a computer vision book. And it's very good. It's a very good read. So I highly recommend that. And also Fougerat, Three-Dimensional Computer Vision, A Geometric Viewpoint in MIT Press. Also a very good read. OK. Do you have any questions so far? Well, you can also ask questions after the recording. Otherwise, we're going to meet again next Tuesday, right? OK, see you next Tuesday.